The more committed you are to your ideals, the more you are morally obligated to be as effective as possible in carrying them out. Pragmatism in the service of idealism is our duty.
Welcome to This Way Out, the International Lesbian and Gay Radio Magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Tokyo deletes gays and lesbians from proposed human rights guidelines, a South African court moves a teen from her abusive father to her lesbian mom, and an on-the-scene and in-the-pink report from the Democratic National Convention. All that and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Chase Schulte.
And filling in for Cindy Friedman, I'm Chris Allen.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending August 19th, 2000. As the Democratic Party converged on Los Angeles this week for its national nominating convention, its gay and lesbian caucus proved that it was firmly entrenched in the mainstream. There were 212 openly lesbi, gay, and transgender delegates, compared to 19 at the Republican convention 2 weeks ago. Out in the streets, a demonstration of queers and allies had a close call with Los Angeles police when about 1,000 marchers disagreed with authorities as to the location of their planned action. The situation was resolved when the protesters left the downtown federal building and marched to Pershing Square, one of the sites designated for counter-convention activities. Not absolutely everything was sweetness and light for lesbians and gays inside the convention either. Lesbian California State Assembly member Carol Migden and other delegates were furious over the appearance of some Boy Scouts among the children delivering the Pledge of Allegiance on Tuesday evening. Migden called it a stinging insult for the party to put an organization that discriminates against gays into the national spotlight and vowed to make sure it would never happen again.
The city of Tokyo is in the process of developing human rights guidelines, but the rights of lesbians and gays are not included in a draft currently being circulated. It was considered a landmark first in early 1999 when the Governor's Advisory Commission invited gays and lesbians to testify at an official hearing and to join other discussions relating to the guidelines. It was an even bigger first when the Commission's December report recommended inclusion of sexual minorities in new measures to protect human rights. So it was a source of anger and disappointment to activists to then be left out of the proposed legislation. Tokyo's gay and lesbian group Occur has been meeting to consider how to generate public support for their inclusion in the guidelines, support the government says it has not seen. When Governor Shintaro Ishihara was asked about the omission of lesbi-gay rights at a press conference, he responded, "In what way are they discriminated against?" Occur's anger has been further fueled by Japan's first homicide to be identified as a gay-bashing attack. They say the February murder might have been avoided had there been less homophobia among the police themselves and more concern about previous reports of trouble in the area, including reports that the two perpetrators frequently attack gay men who meet in the park where the victim died. When Occur requested a meeting with the Metropolitan Police Department, they were refused.
Four local civil rights ordinances protecting gays and lesbians that were passed last year in Kentucky have been targeted by the Pat Robertson-founded American Center for Law and Justice, or ACLJ. But now the lawsuit against one has been dismissed, and the U.S. Department of Justice has called for the dismissal of the lawsuit against another. In ACLJ's challenge to the city of Henderson's fairness ordinance, Christian landlords claimed the housing rights provision in the law would force them to facilitate sin in violation of their religious beliefs. However, apparently the plaintiffs and their representatives failed to read the fine print before going to court. Single-family housing units like the ones owned by the plaintiffs are exempted from the ordinance, so last week it was ruled they have no standing to sue. The Justice Department, in what's believed to be its first intervention to support a local ordinance prohibiting discrimination based on sexual orientation, requested the dismissal of ACLJ's similar suit against Louisville's fairness ordinance. They warned that success for the case could ultimately jeopardize the basic civil rights not only of gays and lesbians, but of people in all groups protected by similar laws, such as those prohibiting discrimination based on gender, race, or religion.
The gay Israeli whose precedent-setting 1997 case won him his late partner's military pension is back in court again. Adir Steiner had hoped that ruling would also give him a spouse's right to add his tribute to Colonel Doron Meisel in the Israeli Defense Forces official memorial tomes. He's finally been granted that, but now he wants the minutes of the meeting that led to the decision. And in order to get them, Steiner is having to sue the defense ministry. The ministry has refused to give Steiner the minutes, saying that some of the people involved might be hurt by their publication. Steiner had forced the issue of the memorial tribute by appealing the ministry's initial refusal to the High Court of Justice. Before the court could hear the case, the ministry brought the matter to its public committee to perpetuate the memory of fallen soldiers. That's the consultation that led to the groundbreaking decision to treat Steiner as a legitimate partner. And that's the discussion Steiner wants to know more about. Using the Freedom of Information Law, he told the Tel Aviv District Court that the proceedings of the public committee were necessary, both for his tribute to Meisel and to help him document his relationship for a pending tax dispute. He believes opening up the deliberations will not only aid the cause of gay and lesbian rights, it will also help to crack the secrecy of the committee's work and thus have an impact on all bereaved families.
In South Africa, there's been an unexpected turn in the controversial custody case of a Pretoria lesbian mother. A 1993 ruling had granted the mother weekend visits with her son and daughter, but banned her from sharing a room with her partner of 11 years while the children were there, and ordered that they not be exposed to anything that might connote homosexuality, such as videos or clothing. However, those visitation restrictions have been lifted in response to an urgent application to move the daughter out of the father's house. The girl complained that her father was holding her prisoner since discovering from her diary that she had been sexually active with her boyfriend. A psychologist described her as severely traumatized and saw the potential for permanent damage should she remain with her father. In temporarily ordering the 17-year-old to be placed in her mother's custody, the judge said the previous restrictions might violate South Africa's first-in-the-world constitutional ban on discrimination based on sexual orientation. The judge will make his permanent decision on the girl's placement after hearing recommendations from the family advocate.
The questions regarding the death of gay African-American J.R. Warren may finally be answered now that a judge has ruled that both West Virginia teenagers charged in the murder will be tried as adults. While local investigators say there is no evidence to support their suspicion, some activists believe the killing may have been bias-motivated. But because the juvenile proceedings have been strictly confidential, few details have been released to the public. That will change now that Marion County Circuit Judge Rodney Merrifield has decided to transfer Jared Wilson to criminal court along with David Parker. Some of the facts have emerged out of the hearing on Wilson and Parker's status. Parker and Warren had argued, and the fight became physical after Wilson took $20 from Warren's wallet. Together, Parker and Wilson kicked Warren with steel-toed boots and loaded him into the hatchback of Parker's car. Warren climbed into the back seat next to Wilson, who pushed him against the frame of the car several times. On a road outside town, they unloaded the alive and conscious Warren, and Parker drove over him four times, twice with Wilson as a passenger.
Tyra Hunter has been dead for 5 years, but the city of Washington, D.C. has finally agreed to a $1.75 million settlement with the transgender's family, who charge that an appropriate response by paramedics and D.C. General Hospital might have saved her life. Hunter was horribly injured in an auto crash, but when a paramedic discovered male genitalia under Hunter's female clothing, her treatment was interrupted for several minutes of jokes despite the cries of numerous witnesses. The city had dragged its feet every step of the way before making even a token investigation or taking any responsibility in the case, despite continuing complaints from activists and even the city council. Hunter's mother told reporters that the settlement represented some measure of justice, but all the outcry has yielded little else. Adrian Williams, the paramedic who discovered Hunter's trans identity and then walked away from her to make jokes, has since been promoted to sergeant. Dr. Joseph Bastian was found to have neglected Hunter at D.C. General's emergency room, and the jury based all but $600,000 of its recommended damages on his actions. However, Bastian continues to practice there, and because he was dropped from the case in the course of settlement negotiations, he will not even be listed in a Federal Registry of Physicians in malpractice claims.
And finally, acid-tongued gay Massachusetts Congressmember Barney Frank had some choice words for independent counsel Robert Ray, whose grand jury probe into the Monica Lewinsky scandal was leaked shortly before Vice President Al Gore was set to accept the Democratic presidential nomination. Caught on the convention floor by a CNN reporter, Frank said, "I thought I was beyond being surprised
by the outrageous tactics of that gang of law enforcement desperados, but this one astounded me. The only thing I can think of is that Ken Starr realized how badly he had misbehaved and how terrible his reputation was going to look. So when he recommended a successor, he tried to come up with someone who would be a bigger jerk than he was, so he would not go down in history as one of the most abusive prosecutors ever. And I think Mr. Ray has borne that out."
That's News Wrap for the week ending August 19th, 2000, written this week by Lucia Chappell and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Chris Allen.
And I'm Chase Schulte.
According to a report in the August 19th edition of the New York Daily News, one of the world's most visible lesbian couples, Ellen DeGeneres and Anne Heche, have broken up. "It is an amicable parting, and we greatly value the 3.5 years we have spent together," the paper quotes DeGeneres as saying. The Daily News reports that unnamed friends told them that no third party was involved in the split. We'll have more on this breaking story next time on This Way Out. The Democratic Party's quadrennial national convention, held August 14th to 17th in Los Angeles, was, like its recently concluded Republican counterpart, largely a media event with very little significant political action. Something that was significant, however, was the ever-growing presence of gays, lesbians, bisexuals, and trans people, and that presence has come to carry some real power with it. So, with Vice President Al Gore and Connecticut Senator Joe Lieberman securely in place as the party's presidential ticket, drumming up constituent support was high on the agenda. And as This Way Out's Matt Alsdorf reports, the GLBT caucus was prominent on everybody's handshake list.
When delegates converged on Los Angeles at the beginning of this week for the Democratic National Convention, there was very little suspense about what would occur over the next 4 days. Al Gore and Joe Lieberman had already sewn up the nomination, and the party's platform had been drafted. So with little substantive work to be done, Democratic Party officials, like the Republicans 2 weeks before them, aimed to use the convention primarily as a way to energize the delegates and send them home enthusiastic about the Gore-Lieberman ticket. Among the constituencies they targeted was the LGBT caucus. There were 212 openly queer delegates this year, a 50% increase over 1996. And for the first time in history, one of the delegates was transgender, Jane Fee, a World War II veteran from Minnesota. Each morning, the LGBT caucus met to hear from Democratic Party officials and candidates. Over the course of the week, the caucus was visited by First Lady and Senate hopeful Hillary Clinton, Vice Presidential nominee Joe Lieberman, the chair of the Democratic National Committee, a good portion of Clinton's cabinet officers, including Health and Human Services Secretary Donna Shalala, HUD Secretary Andrew Cuomo, and a handful of governors, senators, and congressmen. And Dick Gephardt, who will become Speaker of the House if the Democrats achieve a majority there, addressed a fundraiser for the Gay and Lesbian Victory Fund. The messages virtually all these speakers delivered to the queer delegates were the same. First, gay and lesbian voters are not just welcome in the Democratic Party, but are crucial to its success this year. Exit polls indicate that 5% of the electorate self-identifies as gay or lesbian, and if you count those voters that are still in the closet, that percentage obviously increases. Particularly in the crucial swing states, the difference between Bush and Gore is just a few percentage points, which means that gay and lesbian voters could make the difference in this election. Second, they made their case for why gay and lesbian voters ought to want to make the difference. One of Gore's primary objectives in his acceptance speech was to outline the substantive differences between Bush and him. And on gay issues, Democratic officials painted these differences as stark. They repeatedly pointed to the importance of the handful of Supreme Court appointments that the next president will likely make, suggesting that Bush appointees would tip the balance against gay rights for the next generation. They also spoke to the legislative agenda, the Employment Non-Discrimination Act and the hate crimes bill being the most frequently mentioned measures, and argued that with Democrats in control of Congress, both bills would be passed. With Republicans in control, they would remain stymied. At the main podium in the Staples Center, many of those same leaders were careful to include gay and lesbian rights in their wider discussions of social justice. But the references were sometimes more muted or oblique than they were in the caucus meeting. And they usually didn't happen in prime time. With a few exceptions, though, most of the Democratic politicians featured at the convention, as well as spokespeople for ethnic minority communities and the labor movement, seem to have accepted the notion that the GLBT issue should no longer be the concern solely of the gay community. In his acceptance speech Wednesday night, Lieberman told the crowd,
"In my life, I have also tried to see this world through the eyes of those who have suffered discrimination. And that's why I believe that the time has come to tear down the remaining walls of discrimination in this nation, walls of discrimination based on race and gender and sexual orientation." And we will. Together we will.
Gore, too, referenced gay rights in his Thursday night remarks, but he did so by promising to pass hate crimes legislation and the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, a move that seemed calculated to resonate with gay viewers but not raise any alarm among those less comfortable with queer rights.
"And hear me well, we will pass the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. And we will honor the memory of Matthew Shepard and Joseph Ileto and James Byrd, whose families all joined us this week by passing a law against hate crimes. They are different. We need to embody our values in that new law. It's time."
There were upwards of 10 openly gay speakers at the convention, most of whom made at least passing mention of their sexuality, though again they did not appear in prime time when viewership was the highest. Elizabeth Birch, the executive director of the Human Rights Campaign, became the first leader of a national gay and lesbian organization to address the convention on Tuesday night. She gave Gore a ringing endorsement on behalf of the gay and lesbian community and bluntly referred to the Republican Party's platform as shameful.
"Deep within their hearts, they know this to be true, that not a single gay American seeks special or favored rights. We seek simple equality, the right to work, the right to raise a family, the right to serve our nation in every way and to be free from the shackles of brutality and hate."
Tammy Baldwin and Barney Frank, the House of Representatives' two openly gay Democrats, both spoke, as did a number of elected local officials. And on Wednesday, Matthew Shepard's parents were joined by relatives of James Byrd, the African-American from Texas who was dragged to his death behind a truck, to speak in favor of hate crimes legislation.
"Since the loss of our son, Judy and I, among others, have met with many congressmen from both parties who have pledged to support our efforts. But despite the urging of members of their own party, Republican leaders have refused to enact the bill. This is not a gay rights issue. This is a human rights issue. Everyone has the right to live his or her life without fear of physical or mental abuse. Everyone has the right to be different and to reach his or her potential. Matthew was not given that chance."
Visibility for gay delegates was key during these speeches. Cameras panned for shots of groups holding rainbow flags or the Gore 2000 signs that are backed by a pink triangle, which stood out nicely against the sea of red, white, and blue. Over the course of the week, the excitement among gay delegates for Gore and for the party seemed to build, largely because of what they viewed as their genuine inclusion in the convention. They drew contrast to the Republican convention 2 weeks earlier, during which the words gay and lesbian were never mentioned from the podium, and where Representative Jim Colby, the one openly gay speaker, was limited to discussing trade issues only, while some delegates on the floor prayed for his soul. Many of the Democratic delegates expressed frustration, if not outright anger, at the Log Cabin Republicans, the gay group that endorsed Bush at the end of the Republican convention. The Stonewall Democrats argued that LCR's endorsement simply muddied the waters for gay voters and hindered them from recognizing how vastly different Gore and Bush really are on GLBT issues, the clearest expression of this contrast being embodied in the party's platforms. The Democrats' document supports gay rights across the board, including a repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell and legal rights for same-sex families, while the Republicans oppose these rights in language as strong, if not stronger, than it's ever been. There are some who felt slighted by the Gore campaign's apparent unwillingness to address gay issues head-on during the times when most voters would be watching. So most openly gay delegates left with greater enthusiasm and a heightened sense of urgency about the importance of a Gore victory. However, like all the delegates here, they realize they have an uphill battle. Gore is still considered the underdog, and the level of confidence in Los Angeles was clearly lower than it was in Philadelphia, where Republicans were absolutely sure they had nominated a winner. Democrats are hoping that Republican confidence will translate into complacency on Election Day, and that traditionally liberal constituencies like gays and lesbians will turn out in big numbers to tip the scale to their advantage. Reporting from the Democratic National Convention in Los Angeles, I'm Matt Alsdorf for This Way Out.
In my book, Virtually Normal, An Argument About Homosexuality, I explore some strongly held positions about homosexuality in Western society, something that this program has been doing for years. Hi, I'm Andrew Sullivan. From Auckland, New Zealand, to Malmo, Sweden, from Chicago to Costa Rica, listeners all over the world tune in to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine, for information, entertainment, and up-to-the-minute news from lesbian and gay communities around the world.
Of the several speeches by openly lesbian or gay delegates at the Democratic National Convention, we highlight two that may have touched most extensively on GLBT issues. Dr. Juanita Owens, an openly lesbian African-American member of the San Francisco Board of Education, and openly gay Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank. First, Dr. Owens.
All of America has benefited from the contributions of gays and lesbians in America. We are your children, your co-workers, your neighbors, your friends. We are your teachers, carpenters, doctors, bus drivers. We are an integral part of this country. There are even gay Republicans. I don't understand why. Our opponents seem repelled by the very thought. Al Gore supports our right to live, to work, love, and pay taxes, just like everyone else. He will work to finally pass the Employment Non-Discrimination Act, or ENDA, making it illegal to fire or discriminate against someone in the workplace just because of one's sexual orientation. Today, in 39 states, gays and lesbians can be fired despite job performance with no legal recourse. This does happen, and it must be stopped. Al Gore has demonstrated his leadership by ensuring ENDA's recent historic passage in the U.S. Senate. Unfortunately, the bill was defeated in the Republican-led House. When Al Gore and Joe Lieberman occupy the White House, they will put an end to unfair, unproductive, un-American persecution in the workplace. Since 1991, the number of reported hate crime against gays and lesbians has tripled. We are all familiar with the brutal murder of Matthew Shepard. Unfortunately, his death was not an aberration. Hate crimes are acts of terrorism intended to send a message to targeted communities. Well, it's time America sends a message that it is not okay to hate someone because of one's sexual orientation. We must strengthen hate crime laws and include the category of sexual orientation.
I'm here to talk about immorality. The immorality of racial bias in the criminal justice system. The immorality of 15-year-old kids being bullied because of their sexual orientation in high school. The immorality of poverty in this very rich nation. The question is, how do we combat immorality? And as a liberal, I am convinced that the way to combat immorality most effectively between now and November is to vote for Al Gore for president, to help us elect the Democratic House and elect the Democratic Senate. Now let me say something that may deviate a little from the norm in a political convention. Al Gore is not perfect. Neither is Joe Lieberman. Neither is Tom Daschle or Dick Gephardt or me. All we are is the best you're going to get on liberal issues between now and this election. The choices are Al Gore and Joe Lieberman with strong records of support on the important issues of gay and lesbian rights and a woman's right to choose and gun control, or a George Bush who has, throughout his career, done everything possible to undo any possible progress on all three, or a Ralph Nader, who throughout his career has steadfastly ignored gay rights and ignored the right of a woman to choose and ignored gun regulation, and today diminishes and trivializes those central issues to many of us by denying that there are important differences between Al Gore and George Bush. I'm not a big advocate of censorship. I like a lot of my congressional colleagues, but God forbid that they should be in charge of telling America what to read or watch. But if I could do censorship, I'd make it illegal to use the words pragmatism and idealism as if they were opposites. The more committed you are to your ideals, the more you are morally obligated to be as effective as possible in carrying them out. Pragmatism in the service of idealism is our duty. As a committed liberal, as someone who wants to see an end to homophobia and racism and sexism, I believe I have two jobs, as do all of us here. On the one hand, we work every day to try and make this a better country, to improve the context in which we make our choices. No one better exemplifies that than Jesse Jackson. At the same time, on the day when the choice has to be made in a given situation, it is equally morally important to make the best possible choice. That means you are either going to help Al Gore become president and further our progress, or elect George Bush and let him undo it. To those who say, let's wait for perfection, my answer is this. There are gay kids getting beaten up in high school. There are young women in anguish trying to make the decision about whether to carry a pregnancy to term, a difficult decision, and they need not be threatened by the law. There is unchecked gun violence. I can't wait for perfection. I feel it is my obligation to do what I can right away to make improvements in those situations, and that means Al Gore and Joe Lieberman, a Democratic House and a Democratic Senate.
That was openly gay Massachusetts Congressman Barney Frank, preceded by openly lesbian San Francisco Board of Education member Dr. Juanita Owens, each speaking at the Democratic National Convention. Thanks for tuning into This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Chase Schulte, Chris Allen, Brian Nunes, Graham Underhill, Jason Lynn, Chris Ambidge, Rex Walkner, and Matt Alsdorf contributed program material. Thanks also to Cindy Friedman and Bob Young. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded by grants from the Gill Foundation and the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation by Planet Out, from designated contributions by Uncommon Cloud Visa card holders who've chosen This Way Out, and through direct charitable donations from our listeners around the world. For audio cassette information or with any questions or comments about This Way Out, please email us at tworadio@aol.com, visit our webpage at thiswayout.org, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California, 90038, USA. And please be sure to include the call letters of this station. Remember, you can also hear This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. Just point your browser to www.planetout.com and click first on multimedia, then on radio. For the entire This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon, and we thank you for listening on KPFT Houston, Texas, 2YOU Tamworth, New South Wales, WGDR Plainfield, Vermont, and more than 100 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Do stay tuned.